Well, we're back to asking questions, which is nothing new for those of you who've been around here for a while. Many of our sermon titles are questions, and they're hardly ever because we don't know the answer. We at least know an answer, but in this case, what exactly do we mean by faith? What is faith? And as always, faith is not believing what you know is not true. Mark Twain notwithstanding, that's not what faith is. Faith is having confidence in something without necessarily having every last bit of proof there. One of the things that I find so fascinating is that people who say that if you're going to have faith in something, it has to be sort of perfect. And we don't have perfect faith in anything. I mean, I'm pretty sure my car is going to start. But if it doesn't, my world isn't going to fall apart. But I have faith in it. We have faith that things will do more or less what they're supposed to. We don't call it faith. We just say this is the way things are. And so because of that, we tend to take the word faith and put it up on a pedestal and say that it's something so mysterious, we really don't understand it at all. We just hope we have enough. Okay. When I say we, it's a rhetorical we. I'm not saying anybody in this room or on the Zoom call is going to feel that way about it. But that's often what we end up with, is this idea that faith is something that's just so enormous that we can't wrap our head around it. Well, I'm pretty sure James would say that's nonsense. James writes one of the most interesting books in the New Testament. And it's interesting for a lot of reasons, not least of which is because it doesn't really fit with a lot of the other things there. It doesn't fit with a lot of what Paul writes, for example. There's some challenges bringing the two together. And there are people who have spent a lifetime trying to reconcile the two, and that's okay. That's as good a hobby as any. I just don't think we have to. We're talking about living a life in a way that represents the reality of our relationship with God through Jesus, empowered by the Holy Spirit. It's not surprising. There's lots of different ways to look at it. And if you look at them in isolation, sometimes they seem to be not exactly contradictory. At least it's hard to bring them together. So most of the time, I don't try. I remember I wrote a paper on predestination and free will, because I was an undergraduate, and I thought I could probably figure it out, because that's what undergraduates do. They take on things that have been bothering people for millennia and say, I will get the answer. Well, I did not get the answer. What I did get was I got a great quotation from Charles Spurgeon when somebody asked him, how do you reconcile predestination and free will? And he said, why would I do that? You don't reconcile friends. Making the point, of course, that there are things that we may not be able to put together easily, but that doesn't mean they don't fit. And so that brings us to James and all of the things that, pretty much all of the things that Luther disliked about James are found in our reading today. Luther wasn't quite willing to kick James out of the New Testament entirely, but he put it in an appendix with a couple other books. Revelation was in there. Galatians is in there, that he said, okay, they're probably okay, but I don't like them. And Luther came out of a context, as we all know, where people were doing things that they might make it into heaven. And what they were doing, particularly, that drove Luther a little crazy, as well as a bunch of other things, is they were paying somebody for what was called an indulgence. And that got them either directly into heaven if they paid enough, or it took some years, centuries, or whatever off the time they were going to have to spend in purgatory, which back then the idea was that virtually no one went from death directly to heaven. You had to spend some time in purgatory to be purged of what you had done so you would be fit for heaven. It's a doctrine we can discuss someday if you really want to. It's got some challenges, got some attractions as well, as most things do. But that was one of the things that Luther was reacting against, this idea that you do things. you buy things, you do particular acts, you say the rosary the right number of times, you say enough Hail Marys, you do whatever it is, and then you're okay. And what Luther felt had been lost, and I think he was right, was the idea of grace, this realization that God saves us not because of what we do, because we can't do anything worthy of God saving us. And so when Luther is translating the New Testament into German, and he's working his way along, well, he already knows it because he knows it in Latin and Greek, but he gets to this part and he just goes, I can't stand this part. He called it a straw book. In this case, sort of a tinder book. The best use of it was for starting a fire. Because when we look at this, we have this really interesting little vignette, first of all, where James says, okay, if somebody comes into your church and they're well-dressed and you put them in the very best place, while simultaneously somebody not very well-dressed, you put them in the back, there's something wrong. Something has gone amiss. You are putting yourself in judgment over them. And he's setting the stage for what he eventually comes to at the end of our reading, where he talks about this whole idea of faith. James does not say that faith is irrelevant. People will tell you that. They'll say that James is only about doing things, not about faith at all. Nothing could be further from the truth. James is well aware of the requirement of faith. But what good is it if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save him? That's a rhetorical question, by the way. James is not expecting us to answer that necessarily. He's just pushing us really hard to say, if somebody says they have faith, is that enough? That's not the kind of question that we can answer because we're not God. And then he goes on to say that if somebody sees someone without clothes and food and says, I hope you're fine, you're useless. In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. This, by the way, is why people say the church is full of hypocrites. I used to think when I heard this that I thought, well, people came into the church and they listened carefully to what was being preached and it didn't match up with their understanding of history or something of that nature. It was something complex that they thought we were hypocrites and they were probably wrong. And now I realize that they're hypocrites. They think we're hypocrites because they know what Jesus said and they don't see us doing it. Which is a sad state of affairs. And I'm not saying it's this group of people, but we're part of that. Whether we want to be or not, when we identify as church-going people, we're thrown into a pile of ideas and prejudices and thoughts and all of those things. And this is one of them. And this is where it comes from. I think I may have told you the story that Philip Yancey told about a friend of his who they shared a church and they ran into each other and he hadn't seen him at church for a while and he asked if he'd been unwell or something. And he said, no, I just stopped going. He said, well, why? He said, because nobody cares. I said, what? He said, if I come late to church, people ask me why I'm late, why I didn't work harder to be on time. You know, you should do that. Are you being disrespectful of church? Now, this person happened to be in recovery. He said, if I go to an AA meeting and I'm late, everybody says they're glad to see me. Why? Because I'm there, because I matter. Because if I'm there, that means I'm working on who I am in this particular context, namely in recovery, and they're happy to see me. When I come late to church, I'm a disruption and an annoyance, so I stopped going. It's hard to argue with that, isn't it? And I'm glad our congregation has never been the kind that takes people to task for not being on time. I'm glad that this congregation is one that is welcoming, full stop, to people who come here, whether we know them or not, whether we've met them before or not. That's a wonderful thing, but there are churches that don't. And right now, we're seeing this huge backlash against the churches not doing what Jesus says needs to be done. Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself after loving God. It says you love God and then you love your neighbor. What does it mean to love your neighbor? It means you help them no matter what. Whether they're somebody you don't like, whether they're somebody who hates you, you still help them. And what they're seeing over and over again, particularly, and I hate to sort of go in this direction, at the moment what's going on in the South in the political run-up to this election they're going to have in November are churches that over and over and over and over again say that the poor are not worth our help. That immigrants should go away. That the sick should just die if they can't afford health care. And people are saying, this doesn't fit. These aren't people that have gone to Bible college and seminary or university and spent years in biblical study. They have heard enough about the teachings of Jesus to know that that doesn't fit. And that's what James means when he says faith by itself, if it's not accompanied by deeds, is dead. He's not saying you must do deeds or your faith will die. He's saying that one comes with the other. And I've used the analogy before, it's two sides of the same coin. Mobius strips and such things aside, there's no such thing as a one-sided coin. It has two sides. In this case, faith and deeds. Faith and doing things. Believing and doing. You can't have one without the other. What James is saying, not that you do the things that therefore you will have faith, it's that you will do the things because you have faith, and because you have faith, you will do the things. They're inextricably linked. And what James says, at least inadvertently, will say, or not, what James says without really putting in your face is, look, if you're not doing the things that Jesus says are important to do, I'm not sure you have any faith. If we continue this bit of James, but someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by what I do. You believe there is one God. Well, that's good, but even the demons believe that. Belief that doesn't do anything isn't belief. Not just there, in anything. If you believe that a job well done is what you should do and you continually do a lousy job because you don't care, nobody's going to believe you when you say you believe that a job needs to be well done. To trivialize it a bit, but only a bit because this is Saskatchewan, if you say you want the Saskatchewan Roughriders to win the Grey Cup, but you exult every time they lose, people are going to think that there's something wrong there. There's something amiss. If we say we belong to this community of faith, that we belong to the greater church, the big capital C church, and we do nothing that aligns with what Jesus tells us to do, people have the right to say, I'm not sure what's going on here. This doesn't mean we do this every day with perfection. We do nothing with perfection. Human beings can't even be perfectly evil, let alone perfectly good. I mean, it's just beyond us. But when we look at ourselves overall, are we the kind of people that do the things that Jesus asked us to do and demonstrated in his own life? And when the answer is yes, we say, well, there's the evidence of my faith if you need evidence. Because I'm doing this not because you're going to look at me for evidence. I'm doing this because Jesus said do it. And that's enough. So what is faith? We're not going to go with some kind of involved and subtle theological definition. There's nothing wrong with those, but we're not going to do that. What is faith? Faith is doing what Jesus asks you to do when Jesus asks you to do it. And that's enough. Amen.